Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome to Chip Chat. We're recording live at Oracle Open World in San Francisco. And today we've got Dan Young on the program with us from Indiana University. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, it's glad to be here.
Dan, you manage database administration for Indiana University, and today's topic is virtualization of Tier 1 databases. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Indiana University's databases and the introduction of where you are with the virtualization?
Sure. In terms of virtualization, Indiana University's been working with the virtualization technology since around 2003. At that time, we actually became involved in the process simply because we were looking to replace some existing legacy systems that had been sunset. So we were looking for some solutions to some very specific, almost niche problems that we had. Out of that, then, we began our first production implementation in 2003, and we began to grow and gain experience in that technology. And over the course of time, we became very comfortable and confident in the abilities of virtualization. Beginning in about 2006, we had an executive direction to take a very hard look at our entire infrastructure as far as the legacy proprietary systems that we ran, and there was we believe that we recognized cost savings and significant advantages organizationally as far as, you know, with the opportunities to virtualize many of these systems. So we took the approach of first virtualizing our application servers and our web server tiers, virtualizing our own applications that we as IT supported, really just a model of slow progression through the stack. Ultimately, then, we arrived at in 2008 when we, late in 2008, we began to discuss the virtualization of our enterprise databases and what it might take to do that. As we continued to see commodity chipset speeds continue to increase and comparing that to benchmarks, we became more and more convinced that we could run all of our enterprise workload on these systems. And so then throughout 2008 and 2009, we virtualized the bulk majority of our enterprise database systems running on Oracle, and then we actually completed that just in June and July of this year by virtualizing our ERP as well as our decision support systems.
That's fantastic. You know, you painted a picture of, you know, where I was going with this was we've talked a lot about virtualization in terms of application redundancy and driving up CPU utilization within the web and app tier, but approaching virtualization with an ERP and database is somewhat of a different beast in terms of the, you know, the reliability of the platform, the maturity of those platforms. What did you learn along the way, and when did you kind of have the feeling that I know that this hardware and this virtualization software layer is robust enough to handle my most mission-critical workloads?
That's a great question. I think, as I mentioned just previously, the first thing that we took a look at were just general industry benchmarks that said, you know, we believe that we're talking more or less apples and apples when we would compare specific workload cycles between those systems. And then we ran our own series of performance tests. We weren't afraid to make changes, I guess, when we encountered things that we needed to learn and to go forward with that. So we recognize the cost benefit of it. We recognize many of the organizational benefits of these changes, and it was the sort of approach that we really felt like we were going to work hard to be successful and to try to arrive at that. In terms of And there were many upsides. So that's a great question. If you look at something like many of the historical or sort of legacy, I don't want to say legacy because there are many people who still continue to use the proprietary operating systems. They are very reliable. You get five nines and you know, out of the box, and they're very fault tolerant from the hardware perspective. And when you look at commodity equipment, there does seem to be an opportunity to, increased opportunity for some type of hardware failure to cause you an issue. If I look at specifically the case of disaster recovery, in our environment, we were unable to have, from a hardware perspective, redundant servers.
Right.
Simply because of the cost nature of these expensive boxes. So had our data center been struck by a catastrophe, our solution was to quick ship, you know, proprietary equipment and hope that it would get here in a couple weeks and then build the server and restore the database. Whereas today, if we have a problem and we have a physical issue somewhere along the way, firstly, the virtualization software may be able to detect and handle that migration seamlessly for us. So it's very aware of when there's a problem within its environment, and if a server does happen to crash, it will restart that server on an existing or a different piece of hardware. So to us, that was a huge improvement.
Sure.
And the fact that we could afford it. So that was a risk that we were willing to take from, you know, sort of the question of what sort of decisions we made to get there. Granted, I will say that in the higher ed field, that if a system is down, you know, we like to believe ourselves as being highly available, which is true. Our systems are generally always available, but we don't also have a highly available infrastructure in all cases, because if systems are down, we certainly inconvenience our users, we inconvenience our students, and that's not something that we want to do, but it's also not necessarily a life or death situation. So the risk for us is probably a little bit different than maybe some other industries as far as that's concerned.
So you really approached reliability and availability from a completely different perspective, redundancies in VMs, redundancies in physical nodes,
right.
Increased your assurance that a massive catastrophe was not going to slow you down.
That's right. Because honestly, you can have application problems which cause a system outage at any layer in the stack, be it from the software code or whatever, you know, or just unexpected system load or something that may happen along that lines. So, you know, from a pure reliability perspective, we weren't terribly concerned that that would, you know, given those mitigating factors, you know, if we were down for 5 minutes, okay, you know, we can tolerate that and bring the system up then on a different set of hardware. Which,
when moving to a virtualized solution, is there any difference in approach to the administration of the database?
I would say certainly yes, and that's a very good question. From VMware will tell you, and being a VMware shop, they will say, well, you don't have to do anything differently. And I think that at its core, it's true. I mean, the operating system does not know that it's virtualized. But for us, there was a learning curve with regards to, say, operating system configuration. I mean, for us, it was really a revolution, because we moved from sort of vertically managed databases, if you will, amongst my staff, to sort of a horizontal approach, where we worked very hard on standardization and automation and really to make the databases the same across the board. So it gave us the opportunity to not only, you know, change out the hardware, but we reinvented ourselves from the management perspective. And so we took advantage of, you know, at least what we perceived as new features, although they'd been around for several Oracle versions, things like RMAN and ASM and those sorts of things. And being able to sort of fit that right in with the virtualized infrastructure and make that work from the top down has reduced a lot of overhead, you know, things that we would maybe, I don't want to call them menial tasks, but day-to-day sort of care and feeding of the database that we no longer have to do just simply because of how we've chosen to architect the solution. The one thing that virtualization has really brought us in that space and working off this equipment is the ability to quickly provision and clone systems. If development is having a problem or there's a production issue and they want a copy of a system and the database to you know, to play with to see if they can help troubleshoot and debug the issue. In the previous model, we would look at our portfolio of systems and we would say, well, we may have capacity over here on this one this one legacy server to create a database for you, but in many cases we weren't able to accommodate that request from the development staff. We just didn't have the physical resources to do that. In a commodity environment, in a virtualized commodity environment, in an almost cloud-like fashion, we have, you know, just this large pool of resource that if somebody needs to have a copy of a system for a short period of time, that's really something that we can accommodate and turn that around in a very short amount of time. So that has definitely changed our ability to service our customers, and I think that they recognize and have taken advantage of that.
We interviewed VMware talking about some of the recent announcements that they made in terms of mission-critical features that they're building into their solution, support of Intel Machine Check Architecture to allow for individual virtual machine recovery at the memory level, supporting of larger memory sizes. From a database administration perspective, why would support of larger memory sizes or larger core counts matter in terms of the ability to scale your database?
Right. So in terms of larger memory, that one's really, I think, a fairly easy question, in the fact that the more of your database that you can run in memory, certainly the better off you're going to be. That was actually a fairly, I guess I would say, large learning curve for us, and that wasn't so much the moving into the virtualization space. It wasn't so much the result of anything virtual, but just changing out the operating system. So we went from, I guess, if you will, a highly tuned, you know, highly self-aware operating system in AIX to Linux. Not to say that Linux isn't highly tuned, but many of the memory, sort of low-level memory functions and handling that AIX would do for us, just that it just did, we had to actually relearn those pieces. And so when it comes to dealing with things like large memory and large memory systems, I think you just need to be aware that, and Oracle has this really quite well documented as far as the database is concerned, you know, when you deal with things like huge pages and how Linux interacts at that level. Once we understood those details and were able to execute those, we are able to get large SGAs. I believe our largest memory footprint of about a 32 gig SGA, I believe, in one of our systems. And so the more that you can run there, the faster your database is going to be. And so we found that to be a very successful thing. And then the ability to dynamically provision that and increase that memory at the host level too gives us a lot of flexibility if we find ourselves, you know, in the need of a peak or valley. From the processor perspective, we went from essentially a 16-core architecture down to, at the current ESX release, to an 8-core architecture, and we were successful with that. And so, but that being said, now the ability to extend beyond that with ESX5 to go to 32 cores, I think that we'll see some additional benefit from that in our heaviest workloads. So when you begin to look at database processing, you're dealing with some pretty large systems when you begin to need 32 cores of CPU. Not to say that that certainly does exist, but the sky almost seems like the limit to me now at this point, as far as, at least certainly with our organization, and the fact that we'll have, you know, more compute than we know what to do with. And
well, that's not a bad problem to have. and you talked about the flexibility of the solution in terms of addressing some efficiencies for your team in terms of ongoing management. What are the other benefits that you derive from this?
It's got the benefits of this are just... here's a classic example that we actually have been able to execute. About a year ago, give or take a few months, we actually did a wholesale replacement of all of our x86 architecture. And we moved from an AMD chipset to an Intel chipset. And as part of being we think so too. And as part of that migration, we simply did our downtime consisted of a systems restart and a standard maintenance window. And that was because we were virtualized. So from my perspective, in the historical model, if we would have to buy a new P-Series server, we would have to reinstall the server, we'd have to build the database, we'd have to have a migration strategy for the data to actually complete that successfully if it were a hardware changeout. In this case, and only because we went from AMD chipset to an Intel chipset, as far as VMware was concerned, that's why we actually needed a restart. Otherwise, it would have been a seamless migration with no downtime. The savings around that is phenomenal. I no longer care, you know, what hardware my database runs on. It's just the magic, if you will, of a virtualization that allows us to be able to do that. And that's a significant reduction in cost.
You did the evaluation, the performance was there, the capability was there. You know that it's going to deliver what you need from a hardware platform. And really, you're managing at the virtual layer and getting the flexibility at the virtual layer where you don't have to worry about specific hardware-specific platform changes when you move from one version of a platform to the other.
That's correct. I mean, so our general approach as a university is we have a 3-year life cycle for equipment replacement. So, you know, in a year and a half from now, when it's time to replace that hardware, at least to consider that, you know, I'll be interested in the discussions because I'll want to know what the new bells and whistles are that we're going to gain from that. But that being said, I anticipate that, you know, the servers will arrive, they'll be installed, they'll be set up with the appropriate VMware tools and tool set, and we'll just start moving systems, and it'll just happen, and our customers will never know, and we'll have no additional overhead on my team, or for that matter, the system administration team to bring to bear to complete that migration.
This is an awesome story, Dan. We're going to take a quick break. I'd like to remind the audience, please submit your questions on Blog Talk Radio or at Intel Chip Chat on Twitter, and we'll get those answered. When we come back, I want to shift from the deployment that you have to where you think database technology is going in general.
We'll be right back with more of Allison's interview. Have a question? Visit us at twitter.com/IntelChipChat. We'll be answering questions live next.
And we're back on Chip Chat live from Oracle Open World at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, and I'm with Dan Young from Indiana University. Dan, you've been telling me about the interesting journey that your team took in moving from a proprietary database architecture really to virtualizing your databases, utilizing Intel Architecture Servers and VMware, which has been really eye-opening for me. You know, I think that you guys are ahead of the curve in terms of driving those mission-critical apps into virtualized environments. You were just telling me at the break about the heterogeneity of the platforms within your environment and matching performance of a processor with your workload requirements. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. So, as I hope I've communicated, one of the things that we strive to do at the university is really to standardize much of what we do. And that's true through the infrastructure stack. So not only does my team, we try to operate all of our databases, whether it's Oracle or SQL Server or MySQL, in a common fashion. We do that through the infrastructure stack. So we attempt to buy one piece of equipment, commodity equipment to run all these virtual environments on. And we attempt to have a common storage model and really to leverage the advantages that come there with that. What we found out, though, as we began to work through this, and of course Intel has some chipsets which are optimized for virtualization. What we found is we looked at some of our larger workloads, say our PeopleSoft, our ERP, for example, or our decision support environments. And what we actually found was that in certain circumstances, you know, the processor speed matters. Not so much the number of cores, but the individual processor speed itself. And so we have since diverged a bit from our standard now in terms of database servers, if you will, the physical layer. We actually have two models that we support. We have the standard model, which runs the bulk, probably 97% of all the databases that we run. But then for our very specific workloads, specifically workloads which do a lot of iterative processing, a lot of sort of cursor-based operations, we found that, at least in that case, clock speed mattered. So we changed the model so that we could use faster processors. So, you know, it's the how much processor can you get, how much speed can you get, and then number of processors, sort of that algorithm that goes on there, meaning slower speed, you get more cores, or faster speed, you get fewer cores. But we had some, you know, very good response from Intel as far as, you know, feedback that we got and assistance when we were trying to make that determination. And to give you, I think, maybe a practical example of that, we have a, as many most places probably do, we have an overnight batch schedule that runs with our decision support computing environment. And we had a very predictable pattern of about every 3 years, we knew that we were going to need to buy a bigger box to address performance and growth. And as we looked at this on the virtual, inside of virtualization, and as we went through some tuning operations and, you know, looked at that faster clock speed, we reduced our batch processing time somewhere between, I would say, on average, 60 to 90 minutes.
Wow.
And so it was significant to us and to our customers as well, because they're very excited about the fact that, you know, that their schedule finishes, their nightly schedule finishes so much earlier, and then they are contemplating the notion of then being able to open that data for customers at even earlier in the morning than we had previously. So that was just a significant, you know, win across the board for us, and that was all tied to, you know, processor choice and decisions. And so I guess the summary there is that we were very ingrained in the notion of just having one standard, one machine. But I think there are times when, you know, exceptions are maybe
workloads
necessary.
Workloads are varied so much that,
right.
You know, I think that when I started in the data center group 12 years ago, now I feel old, you know, we had a fairly monolithic approach to what we were delivering in terms of server capability. Mm-hmm. And now the model is so varied in terms of the workload requirements. And, you know, one question I was going to ask you is, did you see the root cause of why single-threaded performance was required in certain workloads and why, you know, multiple cores would be a bigger driver in others?
Right. So I believe it has, at least as best we could tell, it has to do with application architecture. We were using some legacy reporting tools, which are part of the, like, legacy, perhaps is the wrong word, as PeopleSoft does still support them, but legacy architectures that were very, that were single-threaded. They weren't multi-core aware. And so, for example, it's the effectively the SQR component inside of PeopleSoft. And we also historically have leveraged that inside of our decision support environment as well. And those sort of processes aren't able to take advantage of multiple cores. They're not aware of that. They don't know anything about that. So when those were executing in the context of these servers, you know, it was clear to us that we'd be much more efficient if we were just able to run a faster clock and not necessarily have to have quite as many cores in our system.
You know, you've laid out this wonderful story of efficiency, and that takes us actually to the segue to our last topic for the interview, which is looking at the future. And you touched on it a little bit in terms of improved response time for your customers. At Oracle World, we've heard all about new innovations in terms of database, and, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around big data and unstructured data and the management of that. We've also heard Oracle talk about in-memory databases and supporting that with some new products. Obviously, that's part of a larger trend within the industry. When you look at the types of response times that you're managing within your organization, is this a near-term opportunity or maybe something long-term as the underlying hardware technology evolves to address that at a price point that makes sense?
Right. If I speak specifically about memory, in the last 6 months or so, I found myself doing some things that I've never done before in dealing with memory as far as response time is concerned, in terms of actually making explicit decisions within inside of Oracle to say, I'm going to keep this certain subset of objects in memory. And that we've ended up down that road, pinning these objects in memory, simply because there have been times when our customers have come to us with concerns about performance in a certain area or another. In many cases, my opinion is that, at least in our case, we're using it a little atypically, because in terms of just the sheer volume of the data that we have to keep, but yet the transactional systems really anticipate that their performance is going to continue to be very fast. And the only way that we can accommodate that in some cases right now is to actually put this data directly in memory and go from there. Then on top of that, we also have an option that we've at least experimented with in terms of solid-state disk.
Mm-hmm.
And so not so much even moving that into the memory layer, but just making sure that that data that you need is available, and that it's on, you know, almost a level three type of cache.
Right.
You know, not, from an architecture perspective, so it's there and ready and waiting. And so I think for us going forward, I think that'll be sort of our strategy to deal with the memory aspect of this, until we continue to see, and we will, we'll continue to see, you know, more memory available in the servers, and probably to the point, I mean, the growth just seems to me to be continue to, you know, get larger and larger and larger. So unless for some reason that trend itself would slow down, you know, we'll just continue to try to take advantage, I think, at least in our shop, of sort of commodity memory as and increase to that, and this then just allowing us to run more and more and more of the database, you know, in mm-hmm. memory. We have a large portfolio of systems, from very small to, you know, multiple terabytes, and in our very small systems, even today, if I would choose to do so, we have the capacity to run those entirely in memory, and mm-hmm. And so that's just, you know, I expect that'll just continue to move forward and to be the case.
What is the, you know, going back to the workload differentiation conversation, mm-hmm. which workloads make the most sense for those types of implementations? I mean, is it really database size, or is it also customer requirement?
I think it's customer. Well, I mean, being more of a database purist, I would argue that in many cases we just have that object relational modeling tools haven't improved data models by any sense, stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you were to go back and which I think, at least in the case of my organization, is often the exception and not the rule, you know, to actually really put some thought into your database design and how your application is going to interact, as opposed to a more of a, if you will, a generic type of structure where we're just going to create denormalized type of structures, mm-hmm. which are not necessarily fast, or at least not as they're built. So that being said, that the ORMs create a very relatively rapid development model. So I think you have to weigh that. In some cases, we have folks who, when it comes to development, they are very focused and know their transaction times need to be short. And so even using these ORM tools, they have figured out how to accommodate that in their approach. So I really think it's a mixed bag, is probably, I guess, my real answer to mm-hmm. that. In that we also see this problem in our PeopleSoft environments, and you know that, and that's just a sheer data volume. You know, we have lots of data in this table, mm-hmm. but we still need to get to it really fast.
Right.
And so, I think each case is individual. Certainly, with the focus though, trying to minimize, you know, the common user functions and the time that they spend to do those sorts of operations.
So, you know, small database size, it could be easy to do, so we might as well do it.
Right.
And large database size, not as easy to do, but we need to do it, so let's take a look at it.
Right, and to make very intentional decisions as in terms of large databases as to, you know, where you're going to spend that resource, because, you know, memory is
it's not free,
but that's right. I think to say, okay, this is the function the user's doing, and this is where they'll get benefit from it. So let's figure out how to make these objects, you know, available to them, and then the rest will follow the standard sort of approach.
So it's been a real pleasure having you talk through, you know, the history of your journey with virtualization and across the entire spectrum of your applications, and including into the mission critical tier, if you will, with database and ERP and other higher availability systems that you're running. Dan, if people want to find out more about what you've done, is there any way of continuing the conversation? Do you have information on your website?
Sure. So if you were to visit any of Indiana University's, you know, if you were to search for Indiana University and virtualization, you'll very likely stumble upon several of the documents and case studies that we've provided. Additionally, you know, if you're welcome to contact me directly. My email address is youngdj@indiana.edu, and I'm happy to talk about this with anyone, and it's frequently I do. Matter of fact, I received a phone call this morning from someone who wants to, outside of the higher ed industry, but had come across our case studies and is interested in looking at their environment to see if that's the approach that they would like to take. So I'm certainly welcome and open to comment and questions, and we'll do our best to let you know our experiences, because I'm quite certain that everybody's will be a little bit different as they go down this path, but it certainly to me appears to be sort of the way forward as we look at database and database technologies.
Well, you guys are definitely ahead of the curve of the average enterprise out there. So thank you for sharing these key learnings. It's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you for the chance.